Don't ever take pictures in an AA meeting. Don't ever take pictures in an AA meeting. Don't ever take pictures in an AA meeting. My name is Clancy Emerson. I'm an alcoholic. I don't mean to be rude, but that's just kind of a very strict admonition. I'm glad to be here tonight. I'm glad to be back in Columbus. I've been here several times. First time I came 25 years ago or so, and it was kind of not a very fancy airport, not a very fancy crowd. I'm glad we've upgraded both of them since I came here last. And this has been a splendid weekend convention. I think you've had tremendous speakers. I've enjoyed all the speakers. Every one of them, I was thinking, I'd enjoy hearing every one of them. I would register to hear any one of them, I guess, except the Al-Anon speaker, which I'd never heard before. And I didn't know what she sounded like. And then all I knew, she married a guy I sponsored. And so she took him away from me. But she gave a great talk. I really enjoyed it. I'd register to hear her, too. That's the way it goes. And tomorrow morning, you'll hear another outstanding speaker, our friend one of the few speakers I know today that makes me think when he talks. But I'm glad to be here today. I was talking to someone earlier today about they couldn't understand why someone in their hometown who seemed to be a bad drunk got sober and didn't go to AA and somehow stayed sober. And that is a puzzlement. There are people like that all over, it seems like. And you wonder, what's their secret? And as far as I can determine, I've been watching that phenomenon for a lot of years. As far as I can determine, there seem to be types of alcoholics. Some types that we don't specify them much, but there are types of alcohol. Oh, I got to say one more thing about that speaker last night. Where are you, Sheila? There you are, Sheila. Love you. Two things. A little late for that, Missy. I want to tell you the funny phenomenon. It really is, you can imagine. I met Sheila when she was a little girl, 10 years old, and she and her little woebegone brother, and I sponsored their father, and I told him to bring them out to California, and they looked like two little refugees from something. And little did I know she'd turn into a hardened circuit speaker. And she did not mention last night what happened to her poor little brother, who turned into an alcoholic too. And he's sober. And a couple of months ago, I gave him his second birthday cake in our meeting in Los Angeles. He's doing very well. And it's kind of a phenomenon. I gave his father his second birthday cake almost 40 years ago. And I gave, little did I think that little snot would get one too. But be careful. I want to welcome all the newcomers here. I wish at least one of them would have had a black eye or had something, for Christ's sake. When they all look healthier than the speaker, there's something wrong with the program. The girl one day sober, she looked kind of woebegone, but not enough. Look a little more down in the mouth. Reminds me of, I was talking in Montana a couple years ago, and there's a girl sitting in the front row all during the convention. And at night when they had the countdown, she acknowledged she had less than one. She was in her first day of sobriety. And I said to somebody, how could that be? She's been here all weekend. She went out and had a couple bottles of beer at dinner so she'd get the book at the countdown. There are people like that out there. I want to thank Richard and Charles for picking me up at the airport. They've been very gracious. They've been with me every time except the couple times I needed them. I could never find them. Thank you, Richard. My plane got stuck in Los Angeles yesterday morning, some mechanical problem. That happens, no big deal. You sit in the ramp for an hour, and then you take off. And we got to Chicago, but we were very late in Chicago. And there's a rule of thumb anyone who travels on airlines knows. If your plane is late, the connecting flight is always on time. If your plane is on time, the connecting flight is delayed. And so I raced across that Chicago airport and got there and made the plane, but my bags did not do it. And so my bags were here, and I got in. We waited for a while, and they said they were in Chicago. And then they called up last night, late at night, and said, well, we've got your bags in now, and we'll deliver them sometime tomorrow. And I said, I can't wait that long for my toothbrush and my clean shorts. So I came down and looked for Richard. He wasn't to be found. I looked for Bill Kibbe. I won't give away his name. And he could be not to be found anywhere. And I nailed poor Mike back there. There was a guy standing there with his girlfriend. She's at her first AA event ever. This was her first night last night. And she went, she liked, and they were sitting talking about what they'd found. And I told them I had to go to the airport. They should stop their talk and get their car started. And we took a ride to the airport and got my bags. I want to thank very much. And that's the way it is. And in AA, Adrienne, that we learn to give. And I'm an old timer. I'm learning to take. But there seem to be types of alcoholics, and nobody ever defined them. But there seem to be some people who apparently are alcoholic by any way you measure them. They seem to drink that way. They can't do anything about it. And something happens that really drastically affects them. They have a lose a family or a death in the family, or they lose an important job, or something really significant happens. And they realize the crisis they're in, and they quit. And they never drink again. And there's a number of cases like that. There's another type of alcoholic who are very similar to that, who are alcoholic, but who have also become physically addicted to alcohol. And these people have to be medically withdrawn. They are the people for whom treatment centers were originally created, to medically withdraw people addicted. It's hard to realize that for us sometimes. We hear all about the terrible drug addiction. But it seems to be a good rule of thumb by most doctors. If you would take 30 addicts and put them in a room, I mean, who are on the drug, put them in a room for 10 days, when you open that door, they'd have some awfully sick addicts. If you take 10 people or 30 people who are addicted to alcohol and are really addicted to alcohol and put them in a room for the same period of time, you open the door, some of them will be dead and some of them will be dying. It really, the withdrawal from alcoholic addiction is worse than drug addiction. But anyway, these people have to be medically withdrawn. And there's a hospital up in Seattle that specializes in that. It's called Chic Chadel. And they specialize in withdrawing people from alcoholic addiction. And they say, and they're advertising, and they say rightfully so, if you come to our facility, we will cure your alcoholism in a matter of weeks. 10 days for withdrawal and then some follow-ups. And you think, isn't that ridiculous? But they have a list of names that won't stop of people that's happened. That's the type of alcoholic. These people come out of there, each step of the way, they discover the nature of their problem. By the time they're sober, they realize what crisis they're in, and they quit. And they never drink again. Then there's another type of alcoholic who seems to be an alcoholic by any way you measure them. They drink and they can't get off it, and something drastic happens. They lose a job or a family or somebody dies or something, and they see the crisis they're in, and they quit. But they always eventually begin to drink again. And the same type of alcoholic being withdrawn from alcohol addiction, they come to the treatment center, they learn the crisis of their problems, and they quit. But they always eventually begin to drink again. And these are the people that have baffled science and medicine and religion and loved ones for 5,000 years. And I'm sure everyone in this room that's an alcoholic is familiar with that. I'm sure there isn't very many people in this room who are alcoholics who haven't seen that look on a loved one's face when they say to you, oh, how could you? You were doing so well. And the kids were starting to feel better and you could get your job back. And now look at you, you're drunk. How could you do this? And, of course, the answer to that is, leave me alone, because I feel so bad I can't do anything about it. But these are the people that we are designed for. These are the people in our book that Bill Wilson refers to again and again. He doesn't know much about different types of alcoholics, but he refers again and again to alcoholics of our type. Alcoholics of our type who cannot stay sober indefinitely, who must eventually drink. And these kind of people have always been a puzzlement. And it's always a puzzlement to, you sometimes you see, incidentally, something's kind of an interesting thing you see in AA sometimes. You see people of that first type, the people who are able to quit, they get lonesome or tired after a while. And after a number of years of being sober, they drop in to join AA. They come and join AA when they're 15 or 20 years sober. And they really are a lethal influence because they tell newcomers, I didn't do any of that stuff, but I'm sober. And they really can kill people. I don't mean they don't mean to, but they're like, typhoid addies. Remember that story? That's kind of a touching story. At the turn of the century, last century, in Long Island, there was a bunch of families who got typhoid fever. They couldn't imagine why, how they got it. And they were dying. And they talked nothing. They talked to everybody in the family. Nobody was sick. None of their servants were sick. But this, eventually they all got typhoid. And they discovered they had a woman who had cooked at all the families. Her name was Annie Sullivan. And they checked her out and turned out she had typhoid fever. But she was of such a nature that it didn't manifest itself in her. She just carried the germs. And everywhere she went, people died behind her of typhoid fever. But she stayed healthy. That's why they call people typhoid Annies, people who distribute death but survive themselves. But Alcoholics Anonymous has designed, apparently, although I don't know if they designed it specifically for that purpose in 1935 or thereafter, but it certainly is the crux of what we are here for. And it's hard to remember that sometimes because we get caught up in forgetting what the goal here is. The goal here is to live in such a manner that I don't have to drink again. And they give us some tools to do it that to new people and sometimes to old people seem to have no application at all to what the hell we're doing here. You know, and that's why it's a continual effort of us sharing with one another, not only sharing with newcomers, but sitting in those seats and meetings and being reminded again and again and again. I think about the sometimes newcomers. We have a lot of newcomers here tonight. You may, in your dark night at home, as I used to do, think, but how does this work? How does this work? How does sitting around, reading all this stuff, listening to people talk about how drunk they got, how does this work? And you can ask an old-timer, and he'll give you an answer. He'll smile and say, how does it work? Let me tell you. Rarely have we seen a person fail. They don't really mean how does it work. They mean why does it work? And nobody knows that. I thought the best example of analogy of that was in the 1700s, the worst disease, infectious disease, or one of the very worst in the world, outside of the Black Plague, I suppose, was smallpox. And people got smallpox and died. Terrible epidemics. I have a book home called Bring Out Your Dead, talking about Philadelphia in the early 1700s, where the wagons go through the streets saying, bring out your dead, and you bring out your dead baby or your dead mother and throw her on the truck and away they go. Just terrible. And nobody knew anything about bacteria or germs. Just like the early days of AIDS, they thought God was striking people dead. They didn't know why. And in London, some young doctor was trying to help people, and he noticed that there were some young girls, kind of a pocket of young girls, who did not get typhoid. Everybody around them did. And the only thing they had in common, they all milked cows for a living. They were cowgirls, they called them. But yet there were cowgirls around them who got typhoid fever, but they got smallpox, and they didn't. And he couldn't understand why the hell this was. And he talked to them, and it turned out the only thing they all had in common, they'd all had a funny little disease called cowpox, which was a kind of a mild disease that cowgirls got when they've been milking cows. And it made you kind of sick, and then you got better again. But this small group of girls who had cowpox never got smallpox, and while everybody else around them did. And he thought, could that possibly be it? How could you get one disease to not get another disease? That's right. Dr. Edward Jenner, great man. But he decided, he ran one of the great medical examinations of all time. He bought a little boy named Jimmy Phipps, 9 years old. And he took Jimmy Phipps, now he owned him, down to where some people had cowpox. And he didn't know how the hell you communicate diseases, so he thought probably the obvious way. He cut a little slash in the kid's arm and took some pus and blood off the people's eyes that had cowpox and rubbed it in there. And the kid got cowpox. And he got better again. Yeah, respected that. But then he took him to the death house where they're dying of smallpox. And he took cut a little knife. This time he took a stick. He didn't want to touch his blood and pus off these people and rubbed it in the kid's arm. And the kid got sick and got better. And for the first time they realized, for some reason they could not understand, if you had cowpox, you would not get smallpox. And still a lot of, in fact, it's an interesting thing, the Latin root of the word cow is vacus. Vaccination means injection of the cow. But even after that, a lot of people said, oh, don't give me that. What do you mean you get one disease and not get another? That's silly. You're just crazy. And a lot of people fought against it and died of smallpox. And a lot of people took it and didn't believe in it, but it worked for them. And it wasn't for 150 years that they finally discovered microbes and bacteria and had microscopes and could see that the cowpox set up a defense against smallpox, this virus of smallpox. Now, they understood why. And if you're new to that, you may consider that someday that'll happen in Alcoholics Anonymous. Someday some crazed scientist will come out of his laboratory. You may be alive, I won't. I've got it. It turns out that a series of actions, unlikely actions, taken under the guidance of a crazed dictator personality, creates a balance in the upper spinal cord that makes it unnecessary to ingest alcohol. They'll say, doctor, wonderful, oh. And everybody in AA will be proved right, but we won't see it. We'll all be dead. But, you know, till then, if you're new, we have to be like the people in 1722 in London. We don't know why it works, but take the cowpox. Take the cowpox. It's the only thing that keeps people like us from getting the big casino. So take the cowpox. But it's hard to get people to do that. I'm in a situation today that most people aren't. When I get up, I live out by the ocean in Los Angeles. I get up and I drive my car in the morning. I drive downtown. I pull into my parking lot. Then I have to step over the bodies of men and women and children dying from alcoholism and drug addiction. Some of you have been in my office to understand that. And I go to my office and all day we try to find ways to help them. And I come home at night and I step over the bodies of men, women, and children dying from alcoholism and drug addiction and get in my car and go home. And you might think, well, why don't you help these people? Why don't you do something for them? And we do. We're not really in the business of selling sobriety. We're in the business of trying to keep them alive, then hopefully someday steer them that direction. But, you know, and I used to talk to these people because I used to be on that sidewalk and I knew how it is. I've got an answer now and you can do it. Come on. And they just blew me off, most of them. And I got frustrated and finally had to stop and think, why won't they listen to me? Then I had to stop and think, why did I slip year after 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 year? The worst years of my life came after AA was available to me and good people were telling me about it. And I just, all I ever knew is, I know that seems all right, pal, but that doesn't help people like me. Because inside of me, I carried that disease that every one of us has carried and will intermittently you'll see it flare up again. My case is different. You don't understand. My case is different. And people carry that till they die. And if you're new tonight, you might look around this room and think, well, what do I have in common? What do we all have in common? You hear all the speakers this weekend. They all drank differently, all had different patterns, different things. Everybody except Joe had a tie on. I didn't mean to let that slip. But they're all different. And you know, I've been sober a long time now. Over the years I've been kind of fascinated. I used to be fascinated by reading contemporary articles on alcoholism, the advance of alcoholic understanding, and notice that science is gradually catching up to AA. God, it's just wonderful. But I'll tell you, you could read all sorts of observations of alcohol, but it's a strange thing. The best observation I've ever seen of the basic premise of the disease is something I've read and heard 100 times before I started to realize, my God, that's the premise of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that is the first page and a half of chapter 3. I've heard that read, and I've read it, and it's just some more stuff. But it really is, it really tells us why we're here, if you're new. It's the basic facts. There's one thing, newcomer, that all of us seem to have in common, people of our type. And we may not even know we have it in common. But it expresses that in that page. It says that we all have voluntarily or involuntarily accepted the obsession that somehow, someday, I will control and enjoy my drinking. It says the persistence of this illusion is astonishing. Many of us pursue it into the gates of insanity and death. You bet we do, about 95% of alcoholics of our type. And then it goes on to say that we have brief recoveries. And we've all had brief recoveries. And throws you off, kind of. But they're always followed by a still worse relapse. And if that hadn't happened, we wouldn't be here. If we were still out doing it, we'd be all fine. We are here because that relapse is hit again and again. And you keep drinking and trying to hold it together. And there's such a dull, lovely little phrase we hear about a lot. Pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization, it says. And I used to think, boy, that's how drunk you got. Just so drunk, pitiful, and drunk. That's how you feel after you're sober again. When you're sober again and the heat is on, and there's pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization, and they want explanations, and I can't even find one to satisfy me. And I just, so leave me alone! Then it goes on a little bit more to talk about what people like us do, the ends we go to. We sometimes change from scotch to brandy or from one type of booze to another. I've done that a lot. If you ever get down in El Paso, get on rum. You can get it across the border, big wicker baskets for $2, and you understand where the word rummy comes from. What's your name? I don't know. I think they got it at the desk. A lot of us have tried things like, they're talking there about drinking beer only. God, I've tried that a lot. Drinking wine only. That's a short circuit, I'll tell you. Taking more there's a wine oh now, isn't it? Person like you shouldn't even drink, Bobby. Taking physical exercise, done that. Reading spiritual literature. Thing after thing, taking a trip, not taking a trip. That's about the only thing in those whole paragraph I did not try. I never tried not taking a trip. When the heat is on, I move it out. That's what I do. It's always been my feeling that only cowards stay and face the consequences. And you just wonder, why would people do all these things? My God, if alcohol is hurting you so much, why are you doing it? And there's no way to explain it, except you might identify it, but there's no way to explain it. And I try to look back at my life, and I think, why would I? I always felt I had a lot of emotions, I guess, and I always felt, I remember when I was a kid feeling that there's something missing in me. I don't know what it is. It might be because I was shoved ahead in school with bigger kids, but a lot of people have had that feeling that weren't shoved ahead in school. But there's something missing in me. When I get close to people, they seem to recognize it, and they don't seem to like me so well. And the people I want to run with don't want to run with me. The people who want to run with me are the people I don't want to run with. And I don't seem to fit in. I don't have a gift of small talk and easy socializing and so on. I'm just kind of a... Now, I thought, when I grow up, it'll be different. And I grew up, and it was different, just had different reasons for feeling different and inadequate, not feeling it. Still, you know, it's tough. When you can't make small talk, you know, after you've said, well, going to be a scorcher tomorrow, huh? And feel there's got to be more out of life for you to say than that. Do you put out? These are not elements of good small talk, folks. I really shouldn't say this, but this is such a wretched crowd, I know you won't remember anyway. I was telling my friend, your speaker tomorrow morning, this afternoon, that when I was a young man, I had a strong, usually unfulfilled, but a strong sex drive. But as I've gotten older, it's gradually turned into a food obsession. And now I can't even get into my own pants. Well, I'll have to wait for that to die down before I'm invited to come back to Columbus. Well, but you needed to know. When I grew up, I had a lot of emotional ups and downs, it seemed like, and always seemed like I had not quite enough somehow. I didn't always feel bad. Sometimes I felt great. Sometimes I felt superior because I did some achievements. But pretty soon I felt inferior. I feel above you or below you. I just never like you. So I had some money. I was a fairly successful writer. And I went to psychoanalysis, which I just loved psychoanalysis. And I used to think, why do I like psychoanalysis? Because all you ever get in psychoanalysis is bad news. You find out that you've been hurt in ways you didn't even know. I was raised in the Norwegian Lutheran Church. We've heard some talk this weekend about the Southern Baptists and how tough they are, and the Catholic Church. Our dropouts became priests. In the Norwegian Lutheran Church, even if you're married for 30 years, you would never make love standing up, just in the fear that some passerby would think you were dancing. It's a tough church. But it's always seemed to be a good church. I learned in catechism, and I was a sinner, and I went to hell after a while. But, I was like that. I wish I could have stayed nice like I was then. In psychoanalysis, I discovered that I had been psychologically repressed by the Norwegian Lutheran Church. I'd like to find that out from about your own church that you always liked. I remember telling that to a police officer while he was arresting me one night. He didn't care any more than you did. I discovered I'd been hurt by the Depression. I didn't even know there'd been a Depression. But when I found out, I could see that it had hurt me. I found out I'd been hurt by being shoved ahead in school. I thought it was kind of a big deal, but I could see, after he explained it to me, that it scarred me terribly. I learned a lot of things. But I couldn't wait to get there every week. And I used to wonder, why was that? Why would that be? And I was sober 30 years before I found out, or 25 years, I guess, before I found out why psychoanalysis. And a guy came to me one day, a guy sponsored, he told me about something I'd never heard of before. So this was a long time ago. He said, I'm getting into this new organization called Adult Children of Alcoholics. I said, what's that? He says, it's a really good organization. It helps us get adjusted to life. He said, do you want to go to a couple of meetings? I said, sure. So I went with him to a couple of meetings. And in the dynamics of the meeting, about the second meeting, I guess, it suddenly struck me. These people are getting out of this what psychoanalysis did for me, whether it's intended to or whether it's meant to or not. And it boils down to this. Probably the worst single long-time emotion I know of in people and me is guilt, deep-seated guilt, especially if you've had a good background or people have tried to teach you right and you just screw it all up. And no matter what you say or how cute you are, down deep you know that you're bad. You're bad. In the middle of the night, you know it the most when you wake up at 2 in the morning. You know, I'm going to go to hell and nothing I can do about it. Now, there's no way to get rid of guilt. I found one way. Getting drunk gets rid of guilt temporarily, but that's no answer. Now, what would you think of a therapy that gets rid of guilt? That's what psychoanalysis turned out did for me and adult children did for these people. You know how they do it? I'll tell you how. You begin by convincing the patient or the client or whoever it is that they are and have always been a victim. You have not been loved. You have not been nurtured. You have not been given the treatment you need to sustain yourself. and a moment of your life, and probably some of it's true, and at moments of your life when you needed help, you didn't get it. And these people turned on you, and they didn't mean to. They didn't care. We heard that a lot in the conversation. We heard the speakers talk about it this weekend, that feeling they had of the children. My parents did not seem to care for me. And as you begin to accept the role of victim, what happens is the guilt begins to dissipate, because it really wasn't my fault. I was made this way without meaning to be. I'm sure they didn't mean to hurt me, but I was made this way. And I'm just a product, a creature of their living laboratory. And I resent it, but that's who I am. And guilt begins to dissipate. And as you get this therapy, you feel better. It seems like you're feeling better. It's wonderful. And you think, well, what's wrong with that? To get rid of guilt, Jesus. Except for one thing. In the world, you'll come to discover, I think, that nothing is ever free. There's always a little price tag. And to get rid of guilt, there are three little price tags you never see at the time, but you can see them in retrospect clearly when you get into victimization therapy. One is, I mean this, one is whether you intend to or not, you must develop and sustain and enhance resentment. Resentment, resentment. You go to these meetings, you don't hear any laughter in these meetings. These are people sharing resentment of how they've been destroyed. And the second little price tag you have to pay, of course, is that you have to accept the fact that you've been made different and there's nothing you can do about it. I heard a guy talk one night, he said, we're like trees. When we were saplings, someone reached within us and ripped out our hearts. We continue to grow physically, we're still all right. But we'll always be empty. We'll never be complete. And the last price tag you have to pay, of course, which if you're like me, you'll understand it, intermittent but intense self-pity. I could have been something if they would have treated me, if they hadn't done these things, and on and on and on. If my parents hadn't got divorced when I was a kid, and I at a stage when I'd never heard of a divorce at the age of 11, and my parents got divorced, I lived in such a cocoon, I'd never heard of a divorce. And it took me in. And all these things, I could have really been something. And if only, it's kind of sad. Because I almost made it big the way I am. If I would have been all right, I'd have really done well. And then you think, well, these are inconvenient things, but maybe it's worth it to get rid of guilt, because guilt is a suicide bringer sooner or later. And again, I guess this is for most people, but not for people like me, and I presume like you. You come here and you read this book, finally, and you discover something strange. The three most lethal emotions for people like me, they specify resentment, self-pity, feelings of difference. And why are they so lethal? Because they will justify every drink I take till I die from it. It will never have been my fault. And you don't understand. I went through that therapy for a while. I did a lot of things. I went to, read a lot of books, read a lot of things. But the best help I've ever had for my emotions, I discovered when I was 15 years old, a screwed up kid, ran away from Eau Claire, Wisconsin, early in the Second World War, hitchhiked to San Francisco, this tall, face full of pimples, dumber than anything. Lied my age, got Seaman's papers, was on the Pacific Ocean in Pearl Harbor in the Merchant Marine with some really wretched guys, the refuse of the world. And they got me to take a drink, which I swore I'd never take. And I took a drink, and I threw it up, and they laughed at me. So I took another one and threw that up, and eventually I held one down. And that day, I found myself feeling significantly better. I would never be able to evaluate how it made me feel. But I suppose, based on later experiences, what it did, it made me feel the way men looked. That was the first time I ever felt that way. And I didn't become a terrible alcoholic. But I learned to drink. And I'll tell you, if you're new, I'm going to tell you something. I hate to say this, but alcohol is the best friend I ever had. I never had a better friend than alcohol. Friends come and go. Lovers come and go. Jobs come and go. States come and go. But when a few drinks is just making you say, you're going to drink it. And the only problem I've ever had is sometimes I have a tendency to drink too much. Or as I discovered in psychoanalysis, I have many times been thoughtlessly overserved. So my battle during my entire adult life was trying to find a way to drink without getting in trouble. And I could do it sometimes, and sometimes I couldn't. I went in the Navy later. I was still a junior in high school. I got out of the Navy, and they gave me some, I was in the Naval Hospital at the end of the war, and they passed on some tests. I always been good on tests. They gave me a diploma, so I went to the University of Wisconsin after the war, and went out in the world, became a sports writer, got married, started working in advertising, public relations, had some jobs, lost a lot of jobs, had them because I drank a lot and caroused a lot, but that's what we veterans of World War II did. And from time to time, I went to AA. At first, I went because somebody thought I might want to go to a meeting in 1949. So I went to a meeting in 1949. And I'll tell you, if you're new to that, this may give you hope. In 1949, these guys were saying, you should have been around in 45. They were sincere then. Turns out they were always more sincere when I was more active. But I would say, but it's nice. Old fools say things like, I stayed drunk around the clock for 20 years. One day I walked through that door, they told me to put the plug in the jug, and I did. And God damn it, I've just never been so happy. They're not like me. But what I did learn as I got working in companies over the years, that a lot of people thought my problem was drinking, and I could always get a couple extra weeks out of the company by saying I was going to go to this new thing called AA, because AA was not very well known then. And you could come home even and get off the, you know, I've decided to go back to AA. Wonderful. It's going to really help this time. I know the girls say so. I know it. What do they want you to do, darling? Well, they want me to taper off. And there wasn't any Al-Anon then to screw it up for everybody. Ever since the birth of Al-Anon, there's never been a moment's rest for anybody around here. No, they don't want you to taper off at all. You have to stop it, darling. We know that. We have our steps, too. I release you, you son of a bitch. I wish I'd have found a friendly one like that Al-Anon speaker we had today. I'll hear about that later. But I went to AA and I went to psychoanalysis, did a lot of things. But my problem, nothing touches my inner core. And the day finally came when, you know, I went down, I didn't bounce back up, and everything left me, and my car was gone, my home was gone, my family was gone. I got a job driving a car from Dallas to Los Angeles. I got as far as Phoenix and got drunk and lost the car and went to jail. And that night a guy kicked my front teeth down my throat. And I came out of there the next day and hustled so many in AA club, got to Los Angeles. And one morning two big guys threw me out of a Skid Row mission. I said, and stay out of here, you mooch. I tried to explain to him, I'm not a mooch. 3 years ago I was on the faculty of the University of Texas. Ads that I wrote, the old L.C. Delmer ads for the board company, were running that very week in Life and Time and Saturday Post, New Yorker. I've had my picture in the New York Times for one of my achievements. How many people do you know have had their picture in the New York Times? But it's really hard to explain these things in midair. And I stood outside of the damn old mission on a cold, rainy morning. And if a guy put a lie detector in my arm and said, you know, you've been going to AA now for 10 years, almost 10 years, and you're dying now on the street, why don't you admit you're an alcoholic? Are you an alcoholic? And I'd have to say, no, but I wish I were. And the needle wouldn't have quivered a 16th of an inch. Because the two qualifications for a membership that I ever saw at AA, you have to admit your problem is alcohol, and if you can do that, then you return to God. And I can't do either one of those, no matter what it takes. Because my problem is not alcohol. My answer is alcohol. I use it. It's like almost like modern man. I sometimes equated modern man's efforts to harness atomic energy. God, when it works so perfectly, but sometimes it explodes and goes all to hell. And returning to God, if God exists, I am damned. And you could say, well, you outgrow that. You don't outgrow it. But like Hitler said, you let me have them till they're 12, and they'll be Nazis as long as they live. They may not talk about it, but they'll be Nazis inside. And when you have been strongly educated that way, and I stood in a street corner dying, and I thought, I got to get off the street corner, and I walked to somebody found where an AA club was, and I walked 72 blocks away in the rain, and my mouth bleeding, and my shirt torn, and my, oh, no, nothing. And I went in this damn old club, the same old sick, goofy steps and traditions, and people, oh, you've come home at last. No, not with you, idiot. And I'd have no idea that that would be my sobriety. Didn't want to be sober. Didn't intend to get sober. For me, sobriety is a lethal thing. I'll tell you what happened to me when I got sober. The one time I got sober, I was in jail one night. I went to jail a lot overnight. Not because I'm a big felon, but because I have a tendency, primarily, when I get to a certain level of drinking, I counsel police officers. And sometimes I step in to stop unjust arrests, and I go in their place, it turns out. But I was in jail one night, just waiting to get out the next morning. Somebody said, you should have stayed home last night. Your little boy died. We couldn't find you. And I had a bunch of little girls and one little boy, and that just about killed me. And I promised my dead little boy, this will not happen again, John Emmislin. If my drinking starts to get bad, I will stop, and I will never drink. And my drinking started, I was working in Texas, I started drinking a little bad, and I stopped. And I stopped, and I had a sense almost of exultation, because I was doing this for my little boy. And my daughters and I, we went for rides, and we did things we hadn't done for a long time, and I was feeling good, and I liked my job, and I felt whole. But then something happened. It happened to me every time I stopped drinking. I thought it wouldn't do it this time, but they did. Somebody sneaked into my bedroom one night and put an invisible spring in my gut. And the next morning they start to tighten it. And it comes out as just a little growing restlessness. Just a little irritability. Just a little resentment that I have to be treated like a child by people who are depending on me for everything. I'm making their company look good, or I'm making their family, supporting their family. And on, and that starts to mount. And the only answer I've ever found against that is a few drinks. And that's why I drink. I don't drink because I'm a drinker. I drink because that eases me off what I need to be eased off. It makes bad things good, and as my friend Hal Marley used to say, makes bad things good and good things better. And I needed a drink, and it started to get kind of bad after a few days. And I needed a drink bad, and I hated the damn job I had. My daughters, I was doing it for a little girl, said, Mary, take your daughters and take your sisters and go to your room. Let me alone, for Christ's sake. I'm sorry, we'll play later. Just moaning. And I didn't know what to do, because I'd taken a vow at my son's casket I wouldn't drink. And one day my wife took the kids to church, and I took the car in the garage, hooked up a hose to the exhaust pipe, turned the motor, went to sleep and died. Didn't my neighbor happened to be sitting in his kitchen nook drinking a cup of coffee, noticed me go in there and heard the motor run. I didn't come over, so he finally ambled over there, see if I was all right, found me dead in the car, pulled me out, beat on my chest, breathed my mouth, rushed me to the hospital, oxygenated me, studied me for days, determined I was seriously mentally ill, and committed me for an indefinite period to the Texas State Insane Asylum in Big Spring, Texas. Now, that's how I get when I stop drinking, folks. That's when I want to stop. What would I do if I don't want to stop? I sure wouldn't. And here I am. I stopped. And I often thought, why would that be? And it can't be this simple. But looking back, I've thought about this many times. A couple little things that are so irrelevant that it kept raining. That's one thing. What's that got to do? Well, it kept me hanging around that damn club. That's what it did. And in the club, you had to be a member to be there in the daytime. The manager said, you're such a mess. You can come in the club during the daytime. I don't want you to stand outside a drowned rat. But you have to go to the meetings every night. And I thought, oh, man. I'd almost rather be a drowned rat than listen to those Oh, I'm wonderful today, and I've got everything going my way. Ha, 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 God, Jesus. But I was sitting in these meetings. But what happened? I tried not to listen, but there was a guy that used to come to the meetings who was a movie actor. And that really impressed me. I know now he was just a minor character actor, I know now. I've been in more movies than he ever was. But I didn't know. I just seen him as a character. Oh, man, that's a... And they started nagging me. I'd been sober maybe 8 or 10 days, and people were feeding me, and I was about ready, as soon as it stopped raining, to make my move. Get a sponsor, get a sponsor. I'll get this movie star to be my sponsor. He must be rich. We'll share his wealth, and I'll get out of here. So I said, Bob, will you be my sponsor? Said, yeah, but I want you to do what I tell you. Oh, sure, Bob. I thought, I'm smarter than all of you in the whole room put together, for God's sakes. And he became my sponsor. And I often thought, you know, they said he wasn't a very good actor, but he really was, because he acted decently around the meetings. That took a lot of acting for him. He turned out to be a right-wing fascist AA pig of the worst sort. Or do this, do this. But he would talk to me. I discovered later he didn't like me. And I'll tell you why. I don't blame him at all. I'm surprised he kept working with me, because I was the absolutely worst form of newcomer that I know of. It's a long-term slipper who knows all about the program already. And you tell him something, and I'd say things like, Bob, I think you're misquoting the book there, aren't you? You just would like to take a piss elm club and just boom, boom. But he would try to help me, and he would talk to me and take me to the subject. And somewhere along the line, he began to get me to understand things that I couldn't understand. I'd never understood. I guess I thought I'd understood. Like, for instance, we talked about the first step. I said, I can't take the first step. My problems aren't caused by my drinking. They are when I'm drunk. But not when I'm sober. That's, nobody seems to understand that. He says, it doesn't say that. He says, why don't you go by what it says in the black parts? She says, are you having some trouble with your drinking? I said, yes, but that's not the... He says, I'm not asking you that. Are you having trouble with your drinking? Yes, I am. Now, it doesn't say that's why you're having trouble when you're not drinking. There's a dash there. That means end of thought, beginning of new thought. Are you having trouble when you're not drinking? Well, yes, but Jesus, am I ever. All right. You're having trouble when you're drinking? You're having trouble when you're not drinking. You've just taken the first step, kid. And that's all it asks you to admit if you're new tonight. You may find deeper and richer understandings later. But all they want to know, are you having trouble drinking? Are you having trouble not drinking? Oh, Jesus. Welcome. And you got to remember, if either one of these things weren't affecting you, you would not be here. When you walk in that door, you make that admission. If you could drink and get away with it, you'd be out drinking. If you could stay sober without going crazy, you'd be out staying sober. When you can't do either one of them, you come here and say, but I'm not like these people. It always reminds me of people sitting in AMA, see, they don't belong here. That famous story about this girl going to the doctor. She says, doctor, I've been having some funny feelings lately. I threw up in the morning. I'm not feeling well. Could you give me an examination? And he examined her and came back and said, I have some wonderful news for you, Mrs. Brown. She said, I'm Miss Brown. So I have some bad news for you, Miss Brown. I believe you're pregnant. She said, can't be. What kind of a woman do you think I am? I've never been touched. I wouldn't do that. Don't ever say that. And he walked over to the window, pulled back the shade. She said, what are you doing that for? She said, the last time this happened, there was a star in the east. I don't want to miss it. That's what it means to sit in an AA meeting and say, I don't belong here. If you ever got so bad you ought to come here, you belong here. And so I accepted that. And I came to believe I was an alcoholic. He pointed out to me why I'm an alcoholic. You discover this a little later, after you discover you're an alcoholic, that you have to be one of those people for whom alcohol has an unusual effect. Makes you stay drunk all the time? Not at all. Alcohol has to do something special for you that it doesn't do for very many people. When I drink alcohol, although I never knew it, it must almost instantly change my perception of reality. It must almost instantly change my relationship to the world around me. It must almost instantly make me taller and more self-contained, and them smaller and less frightening to me. And if it does that, baby, you'll never find anything better that I ever heard of. And the only trouble, if it does that for you, you must eventually use it again and again and again until you must have it. And you think, well, why wouldn't you get sober and get rid of it? And people do. But they can't stay sober. Why not? And the explanation he had, which it's kind of hints at the book, but I believe to be accurate for people like me. He said, you know, when everybody grows up in the world, as they grow up, they face conflicts and problems and situations and good things and bad things, and they learn to cope with them and learn to work through problems, how to stay out of certain problems. He said, that process is called maturing. And when you get to be a mature adult, you live pretty comfortably because you don't get yourself in bad situations, something you can't do anything about, but you don't overreact to them. You live in the world and you live with some degree of comfort. He said, that rarely happens to alcoholics. I said, why is that? He said, because when we come across pain or difficulty, we have learned that taking a few drinks will get rid of it. I'm feeling very sad tonight. There's some good reasons for it, but I can find a way to solve it. Here's to you, household finance. And on. Okay. But then these problems go unsolved, really. And all of a sudden, now you want to stay sober. You're grown up, you want to stay sober. And never have any idea. I wouldn't have guessed this on my own in 100,000 years. Grown-up body, grown-up strength, grown-up ability, grown-up skills, grown-up fluency, grown-up talents, and never once had the slightest idea that all of these at their intermittent beck and call of childish emotions. We call them alcoholic emotions because it sounds a little more gratifying. Oh, that's my alcoholism. But what are alcoholic emotions? Stop and think. You see them every day around here. I love you. I hate you. You hurt my feelings. I'm going to run away. I don't think I belong here. Let's get married. Jesus Christ. And these problems grind away at you. I mean, this discomfort. Till you finally get to a point where you got to have some relief. And relief comes in a few drinks. And so you drink till you have to get sober. Then you stay sober till you have to drink. Then you drink till you have to stay sober. But every time you go forth and back, your mind tells you, see, it wasn't the alcohol at all. It's all this other stuff that people don't understand. And there's a name for that problem, and it certainly is not called alcohol, because alcohol is only a part of it. That's what they mean when they say alcoholism. Alcoholism is the condition that contains untenable drinking with untenable sobriety. And once you have that, there is no exit anywhere. Some of the greatest people in the world have tried to beat it for 5,000 years, and they haven't. And that's why it's so important to accept this, because this is, you are sitting, if you're new, you got to remember, there's some more sobriety in this room tonight than there was in the world in 1940. And maybe 1945, and maybe 1950. Because people like us always drank, always eventually drank, or took pills or did some terrible thing, got away, and now they're not doing it. There's a lot of people staying sober. Now, why would that be just by stopping drinking? It isn't. Because one of the great laws you'll understand if you're new, being sober is not the goal of Alcoholics Anonymous. Being sober is the entrance to Alcoholics Anonymous. And once you are sober, you better start moving, pal, or you're going to be unsober again. And over a period of time, you'll run across these episodes. The other thing that bothered me the most, I'll talk about briefly, I don't want to keep you from dancing. First things first, you know. I remember when I was in heat, I wanted to dance. I don't remember very well. I still chase girls, but I don't remember why. Anyway. I could not return to God. And I said to my sponsor, he started talking to me about Ed nudging me about the steps and, you know, getting on the steps. I said, Bob, I said, I had no front teeth, but I learned to hold my lip like this. So a lot of people just thought I'd been burned. I said, Bob, I know you're trying to help me, and I know a lot of AA is pretty good. I can see it, but I cannot return to God. He says, it doesn't say that. Nothing in AA ever asks you to return to anything. Oh, to a power greater than myself. Is that what I'm supposed to return to, Bob? Does that fool the others? If it doesn't fool me, I'm smart. He says, it doesn't say that. Nothing asks you to ever return to anything because you'd be going back to sick misperceptions of reality. It says you come to believe in something. That's what the second step says. Come to believe. Can't you believe in God? I said, no, I can't, Bob. I would if I could, but I just can't do it. He says, can't you believe in AA? I said, no, AA is too religious for people like me. It's got a lot of good things, but I can't go all this religious crap. He says, you think I'm doing better than you are? Oh, of course you are. He says, congratulations. I'm your new higher power. And you can laugh, but that saved my life. He could not send me to hell. He tried. But over a period of time, I'll tell you, I want to make a point here. As he gradually worked with me, a feeling overtook me that I couldn't believe. I begin to think, Jesus, this guy knows how I feel. I had never been around anybody for any length of time. I thought they knew how I felt. I thought people did, but turned out they didn't. But I believed he knew how I felt. Now, what was important about that? I'll tell you why. Everyone in this room who is an alcoholic has had enough advice to last them for 10,000 years. Alcoholics just invite advice from everybody going by. You ought to do something about that. Why don't you go to work? Why don't you get a job? Why don't you leave town? After a while, you just fluff it off. Thanks a lot. But if you can find someone who you believe knows how you feel, that advice turns into meaningful information. And you will find yourself doing things to please that person that you wouldn't do for your father, you wouldn't do for your doctor or your minister or nobody else. And if you're new, I want to tell you something. Sponsors tell you some dumb things. Dumb things. They don't actually say this, but it sounds like this. See that wall there? That's vivid red. I don't think so, Bob. That's more of a brownish gray, I'd say. So I'll tell you it's red. It's brownish, I tell you. Well, goddammit, you act like it's red. Now, they don't tell you the color of walls, but they tell you things equally stupid. I don't care how it looks to you. Apologize to that woman. You called her a bitch. Oh, Jesus, Bob. She is a bitch. She told her newcomer girls to stay away from me. Well, she's absolutely right. You apologize.
Sorry.
Bitch. I don't care how it looks to you. Don't quit that job. Jesus, Bob, I used to be a big executive. I'm stuffing envelopes for 85 cents an hour, Bob, and they treat me like a piece of crap, Bob. You know, I shouldn't have... He said, you're lucky you got a job. Keep doing it until you get a better one. Stay there. I don't care how it looks to you. You go to that meeting. Oh, but Bob, it's just a big clique. It's just an in-group, and they just all sit around. They all like each other. And they treat people, newcomers like me, like a piece of crap. Well, maybe they're right. Go to the goddamn meeting. And this goes on and on and on. And one day you turn around and the damn wall has turned red. Then you have to spend the rest of your natural life dealing with dumbbells who think it's brownish gray. But as a result of those things, little by little, my perceptions change. And eventually, one day when I was 6 months sober, I was going to commit suicide, and he took that pain and got me to write an inventory. I swore I'd never write. And I was so upset, I put in things I never told my psychiatrist. People say, why don't you tell your psychiatrist? Because when you're paying that kind of money, you can't risk rejection. That's why you don't tell your psychiatrist. I don't want some little wussy to say to me, you did what, sir? Get out of my office. But first, wash off that chair. And I took an inventory. Much to my surprise, I read it to him. I couldn't believe it. I thought he's going to make me get out of his car and walk home. But he said, that's the best thing you've done since you got sober, kid. He got me to make amends to people I never would have made amends. My father, who I hated, hadn't talked to him in 10 years. As far as I was concerned, he deserted my mother and I, caused a lot of my problems. He said, that may be, kid, but you're a rotten son. You go make amends. And talking to my father for a period of time, I got a different opinion of what had happened, because it looked all different. In fact, he eventually came to live with me in California when he was old and feeble, and when he died, I was with him holding his hand, and he smiled, and I smiled. And I've often thought about that as a perfect example of AA's action. If you'd come up to me tonight and say, based on everything that you know in your childhood and your adulthood about your father, tell me about him. I'd say, that dirty, rotten son of a bitch, he deserted us, he never did anything for me, he didn't seem to have any interest in my children. When I was overseas, he didn't seem to be bothered. He got remarried, he had another kid that he seemed to like better than me anyway, and just to hell with him. He's dead now, and I hope he's in hell, and I hope they're sticking him with sharp sticks, because he deserves it. If you'd come up to me and say, based on what your experience in AA has been, what tell me about your father. I said, Jesus. My father and I certainly saw things differently, but after I got talked to him and understood him, I realized he thought I'd deserted him because I treated him so badly. He just backed off. And he wept because I was his favorite all my whole life. I found out later. And as a result of AA, we got very close, and he's dead now, and I hope he's up in Norwegian heaven, which is called Valhalla. And I hope he's saving me a seat. I hope I'll see him one of these days and talk about it. Now, what changed? Nothing changed. Just the actions of AA changed my perceptions of the same things. That's what it does here. And little by little, my perceptions changed. I came to believe in AA, because AA changed my life little by little. When my sponsor died, I got another sponsor who was a great spiritual leader, a guy named Chuck C. And I didn't take him because he was a spiritual leader. Spiritual leaders were still a pain in the ass to me. But he's the most active man I knew. He was always helping people and always doing something. And I knew that I had to go at that speed if I was going to stay here. I don't want you to miss a word of this, Ashley. I'll start over. My name is Clancy Emerson, and I'm an alcoholic. But he was a great spiritual man, but he wasn't a religious man. He was a spiritual man. And I always think, my first sponsor made me do things. He never once asked me to do anything. Just once he asked me to do one thing. In 1966, I called him, and he said, you know, the Dodger World Series game Friday is sold out. I said, yeah, I know it is, Chuck. He said, I really would like to have 2 tickets for that game. I said, you would? He said, yeah. I said, okay, I'll see what I can do. And Jesus, I want to do this. He'd been my sponsor about a year, and I wanted him to really know how wonderful I was. I sponsored a guy named Byron Wallin, who was a classmate of Sheila's father. And he was a year sober, and I knew that he had 2 tickets to the World Series. And I called him up. I said, Byron, this is Clancy. How you doing, pal? You know, we sometimes we get a chance to do something that we would never get a chance to do. I implanted guilt and gave him a chance to overcome it. And I snatched those tickets and went down to my sponsor. I forgot to mention I got it from Byron. I said, here they are, Chuck. Let me know if you need anything else. And later on, Byron told him that I'd gotten them off him, and he denounced me for it. But what a big thing. But what he got me to do eventually, was I listened to him talk. He talked about prayer. And I thought, I can't pray. But I tried to pray. And I discovered one of our other speakers said this. I eventually came to understand God didn't hate me. That's just an egotistical fixation of mine. God loves me. If God is there, he loves me. He loves me as much as you, no more, no less. He loves us. You got to believe he loves us all the same. And somehow or other, I've got to get my life in some kind of order so some of that grace can get through from time to time, because there's a lot of fog around my head. And I'm a human being, and I can't ever become wonderful, I guess, because no matter how hard anyone works the program, you never rise above human being. And human beings are fallible and emotional sometimes and petty. And we, AA recognizes that, you know, such things as discovering that our perceptions can change from day to hour to hour, even after all these years of sobriety. That's why they say don't get too hungry, angry, lonely, or tired. When I get hungry, I don't change, but everybody around me gets to be stupid. When I am angry, I sometimes believe God wants me to kill them for their own good. When I'm lonely, I sometimes feel all of those people I've helped, they're all somewhere having a party. They didn't tell me, did they? No, I'm too old now. When you're tired, they literally attack you sometimes. On the freeway, I do go out a lot and talk in places. And I get back and I have to get up in the morning and go to work. And I know when I'm tired and I can conceal it very well. I'm an old timer. I'm a master of acting different. But they know it on that freeway. You can just see some little old lady up at La Cienega saying, "Say the boy in the Blue Riviera, he's exhausted. I'm going to cut that son of a bitch off." But the great thing about AA is this. Since I've been sober, I no longer have to chase people past my exit. If I haven't caught them by 4th Street, I say, "Good flying, Red Baron. We'll meet again." And when you do catch them, you can't do anything, but you can get next to them and give them a ray. You go. A few years ago, a little girl cut me off. I was coming off the Santa Monica Freeway under the Harbor Freeway, and she cut me off, and I came this close to dying, and we were doing 60, and we were, oh, man. And I made an exception in her case. I chased her past my exit. chased her halfway up to Pasadena on the Pasadena Freeway, but I finally got next to her through some great driving, and I gave her a quintuple ray. I was... And I suddenly realized she was about 17 years old, same age as my granddaughter, Katie Doherty, at that time, just an innocent little girl going somewhere and probably learning to drive, and this grouchy old Grinch doing that. And I thought, what the hell's wrong with me? And I smiled. And she went... But those are the things that happen out there, folks. And you're going to have emotions, you're going to have ups and downs. But here you learn a little bit. I think, because it turns out the purpose of alcohol, let me say this to get over this over with now. The purpose, you say, what is the purpose of AA? You say it isn't to be sober. It is to be sober, because you can't, unless you're sober, you can't be here. There are no drunken AA members. Being sober is the entrance to AA. But what's the purpose of it all? And I firmly believe and bet my life on this, and I'll continue to do so. The purpose of AA is to very slowly do what alcohol did fast. to little by little change my perception of reality, to change my relationship with the world around me, to little by little make me a little more self-confident and them a little less frightened. And that's what it's about. And that's why I've come to believe in a power greater than myself that I can pray to and try to live under his dictates as best I can. I don't do a very good job of it because I'm a fallible human being, but I do the best I can. And there are other great things since just the first of the year. I was telling some people in my group, one of the great things I've learned, a lot of people make resolutions, New Year's resolutions. I'm going to do this, I'm not going to do that, on and on. And in AA, we have a wonderful experience because every night here is New Year's Eve. And every day is New Year's Day. And if you fail today, try it again tonight, folks. Make that resolution again tonight. You can do it again and again and again until finally one day you're doing it. I'm very glad to be here, safe and sane and sober. I'm glad that Alcoholics Anonymous has made my life something I want to live. I something like something Bobby said today, and one of the other speakers also said it too. Maybe it's corny, but I maintain my enthusiasm for Alcoholics Anonymous. It's been a long time. It took me a long time to get it. You know, around AA, you will see in your groups, if you're new, there's always a few little sharpshooters, little dinks. They say things like, oh, AA's all right for your drinking, but how about your emotions? Maybe you better see a doctor. Maybe you ought to have some antidepressants. Maybe you better do this, maybe do that. AA's not enough for emotions. I've been in jail 32 times, which is not a world's record, but it's good for an advertising executive. I've been in the Wood, Wisconsin Veterans Hospital in a rubber room. I've been tied down in the Beloit, Wisconsin Municipal Hospital while my wife came in, had a baby, and went home again. I was still there. I've been committed for an indefinite period up to the rest of my life in the Texas State Insane Asylum as a schizophrenic with paranoid tendencies. I think I can speak on behalf of the emotionally challenged. And as the spokesman for the emotionally challenged, let me tell you, Alcoholics Anonymous, as it is, if you get involved in it and get a sponsor and do the things and keep doing them, will work at least 46 and a half years. It may not work any longer, but it'll work that long. So do it that long and then come and see me. Thank you.